Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka, welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggles for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, racism, socioeconomic class division, and gender-based violence. Joining us on the line from Cape Town is Ms. Susie Brockenshaw, who is the editor of Fair Lady and Lose It. She has been the editor of Fair Lady for the past 11 years. Under her leadership, this iconic South African brand has grown and diversified while still retaining its authentic, original, and passionately South African voice that connects and supports a diverse network of contemporary South African women. And on the other side, she launched Lose It in 2014, which focuses on the Banting way, providing information about the Banting lifestyle. Welcome to the show.
It's so great for me to be here. Thank you.
Now, kicking straight in, as a magazine editor, you're tasked with multiple responsibilities, which range from serving readers with relevant content to delivering audience figures for the commercial aspect of the publishing business. And these days, it's not limited just to the print environment, but extends across to online platforms as well.
Yeah.
What is your greatest challenge in this role?
You know, it's so difficult. When I started years and years ago, it was actually what we needed to do as magazine editors was very clear. We needed to curate content and we needed to deliver it to an audience that we already knew pretty much was there, and we also knew pretty much what they wanted. And over the years that I've been in magazines, this has changed profoundly, because now the audience as such is not a loyal audience. They're getting information from a whole lot of different sources. I think the huge challenge for us is to retain a community, because that's what you really want as a magazine. You want to create a community that you can talk to, that you get feedback from. And it's a huge challenge in a world where we are no longer just competing for leisure time. We're competing for content with Facebook. We're competing for that sense of community that women used to have through magazines, particularly in South Africa, because we didn't have access to very much else. And we've got so much competition now that that's a huge challenge. Obviously, that's the first thing, is to retain that sense of community. And the second thing is, and it's a challenge across the media business, as you will know, is how to make it a business. Because where content is ubiquitous and it's free, how do you make money out of delivering content? And it's very, very difficult. So I think that that's the big challenge facing all media as we go forward.
I think those are two really valid points, and it's interesting in terms of this whole transformation that it is about going forward and trying to retain a community, build an ecosystem, and cater for people's multidimensional tastes, environments, and media consumption that happens sort of in this interstitial space, that it's not just restricted to leisure time or necessarily one direct source.
Exactly. It's very difficult, and I know these are challenges that are worldwide. I think Media 24 over the years, they've had some really, really good conferences with some really interesting speakers. And so we've had speakers from BuzzFeed, from Quartz, from all the huge international media companies that seem to be getting it right on one level. But on another level, they're finding it very difficult to monetize.
And moving forward into your career as editor-in-chief of two publications, what milestones do you want to achieve?
Well, I think that would be the biggest milestone, is to work out how to go forward in this industry, to work out the business plan that would sustain magazines into the future. Because I think that magazines will exist, but it's in what format they'll exist and how much of a voice they'll have. And I think it's very critical to keep a particular voice in the media atmosphere or the media environment. And with kind of the democratization of media, which I completely support on one level, what it also does is it kind of makes the world blander, because there's no distinguishing voice, or there are very few distinguishing voices. There's first of all that, and then secondly there's the problem of confirmation bias, obviously, where you just seek out news feeds or you seek out information that kind of already just supports your own view. And I think both of those are incredibly dangerous, because I think they lead to kind of a more dispersed society, a more disintegrated society. And I think that that's a huge challenge, is to, as I keep saying, to create that sense of community where you can still surprise your readers and give them information that they might not necessarily have sought out on their own.
I agree with you. I think it's almost like a directed myopia, which really can be dangerous.
It's so dangerous. I think it can lead absolutely in the worst form to kind of massive fundamentalism, because it just reinforces your own belief until you've got no idea that there's any kind of opposing point of view.
And recently I've been thinking quite a lot in terms of these shifts. If you think about it from a Facebook point of view as being a model which has totally transformed the media business, purely based on advertising, purely based on looking at great swaths of consumer databases. I think the recent figures are something like 1.79 billion users on a monthly basis.
It's incredible.
And it's flipped other business models on their head. And the reality is one can't really compete directly with them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the interesting thing is that I keep on thinking about how do you support journalists? Because when we talk about monetizing, it's not about kind of getting rich off the business. It's about being able to pay people to do the proper research that's necessary to report on the ground. That's what it's really about. So, like, for example, I saw that one of the huge reports on Syria had been, the journalists had been paid by George Clooney. And I wondered whether we weren't moving back into some kind of patronage where actually it becomes kind of incumbent upon the very rich to support freedom of speech in a way. And I think that's really scary. But I can't work out how else to be able to support journalists, spending 2 years doing a story, doing a total in-depth story. It's a huge conundrum.
That's certainly a challenge that the industry faces.
Yeah.
If I can ask you now, if you could reflect back on some of the landmarks in your career.
Well, I think, you know, for years I worked on international titles. I worked on Cosmo and I worked on Marie Claire for a long time. And what really was a milestone for me was working on a title that was an authentic title, that was a South African title, that was an original magazine where I felt that there was much more place for an original South African voice. So I would say that coming to Fair Lady was a fantastic thing for me. And I've really loved my decade here. It's been so interesting, obviously ups and downs and huge challenges in the media environment. But it's also been about South Africa becoming a more democratic country and how the magazine has reflected that and how we've gone forward, despite the name, Fair Lady, which, by the way, is totally silly, but was based on Pygmalion.
So it was from My Fair Lady. I've always wondered.
Yes, it was from My Fair Lady. It's a totally ridiculous name. But the beginning, I don't know if you remember that the tagline all those years ago was, I think it was for the woman you want to be. So it was Fair Lady for the woman you want to be. And it was about personal transformation, I think, was the idea behind it. And so it came from My Fair Lady, from Pygmalion. But anyway, to be able to transform, despite the name, in a country, that's been a great challenge and a great joy. The other milestone, I would say, was Lose It, not because of the subject matter, but for me it was about, or necessarily, but for me it was about seeing a gap in the market and being able to act very quickly to fill that gap and to fill it successfully. And that sort of got me interested in the idea of pop-up publishing as a space to be in, that you see a gap and you decide how best to fill it. Is it a digital magazine? Is it an event? Is it a print magazine? Is it newsletters? I think that I found a very kind of expanding experience for me, intellectually expanding. So, yeah, I was very happy with that as well.
I must say, I think Lose It is particularly interesting, and especially, as you say, looking at a gap in the market and being able to respond as quickly as you have, because often that's another, I suppose, an inherent problem that publishing has, is that it takes a long time to turn things around.
Yeah, and digital, everybody thinks kind of digital is so fast, but it's not fast because you have to design the site, which seems to take months. You know, it takes a long time, which was part of the reason that we decided to go into print. But it was very gratifying to be able to do it so quickly and for it to be so successful. And the other interesting thing about it is that it's a different model. It's a different business model. There is no advertising in it. so that we could be in a position, because it's such a very specific subject matter, we had to be in a position where we could turn down advertisers and we didn't have to rely on their income.
From a business model point of view, is it purely paid for?
Yes, it is. It's got a very high cover price. So the cover price is $49.50. And why we did that was that we worked out that it was such a niche product that the people who wanted that magazine would actually pay $50 every 2 months for the magazine, for the joy of it being a totally honest publication that didn't need to take kind of weird diet ads to sustain it. And actually, that is the feedback that we've got from readers, is that they really like it, that it's not stuffed with advertising, and that it's not stuffed with advertising that is contrary to the message of the magazine.
So it's very, very authentic, and I think experimenting with looking at opportunities of how to monetize and target those specific communities.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing, for me personally, it was it's such an interesting magazine, because why I became interested in low carb in the first place was my dad was a late onset diabetic, and he went on to the kind of the traditional diet, which was high carb, low fat. And he still had a stroke and he still died. And I see diabetes being an absolutely huge issue in South Africa. And I actually really believe that the treatment is wrong.
So in a way, it's also responding to a societal need and adding an element of social responsibility.
Yes, I feel that very strongly about Lose It. I feel that the success rate in terms of diabetes is kind of unquestionable. And I think in South Africa, it's essential that we deal with diabetes.
Well, thanks for sharing some of those contributing factors which have driven your career and also shaped your attitudes in some of the choices that you've made.
Yeah.
Looking at women within the media environment, I came across a study in 2015 from Genderlinks, and I was quite surprised at the stats that they showed looking at the Southern African region. It found that the ratio of women to men studying media is 64% in women's favor and 36% towards men. But despite this bias, women only account for 40% of media employees in the market at the moment and 34% of media managers. And then a further more worrying factor for me was that women's views and voices only represent 20% of news stories in Southern African media, which is below the global average of 24%. Now, with your publications, particularly Fair Lady being a magazine for women, do you think in a way that it excludes you from those stats?
I really do think it does. And I'm sorry that I can't give you a broader view on it, because I think those stats are absolutely horrifying. But for me, I've always worked in women's magazines. I've had a male boss. I've always had women publishers that I work with. The CEOs that I work with have always been female. In my magazine teams, they are 98% female. I find it interesting in terms of news publications, because so many of the big newspapers in South Africa are edited by women at the moment. Obviously, there's the Mail and Guardian, edited by a woman, and now the Huffington Post is edited by a woman. City Press. So I think that, yeah, they're not the biggest, but they are newspapers with a strong voice. Having said that, I'm not sure how much of the content is actually women's voices and how much of it is women-orientated. But my experience has definitely been skewed because of working in women's magazines.
And within that environment, again, it's almost looking at the ecosystem nature, but I think that by having more women in that environment, you are probably hiring more women in that environment, so it's sort of expanding and keeping that population of females in the group.
Yeah, point is to be a woman's voice for Fair Lady, and so we are much more likely to hire women as writers than we are to hire men. In terms of design as well, I think we've always worked with women. So yes, we are skewed in favour of women.
Well, it's reflective of your audience. I do think that makes a lot of sense.
Yes. Now, you know, there's always been that debate in literature about whether a man can ever entirely successfully write from a woman's point of view. And I think it's an interesting thing. I remember Carol Phillips years ago wrote a book, and he wrote it from a woman's point of view, and he faced huge criticism, even though I thought it was really well done. I think that those boundaries are blurring more now, but it's still a contentious thing.
It is indeed. And one of the challenges that we have from a gender equality principles is looking at the dynamics between work, life, home, career, balance, as well as development. As a successful woman who's worked hard to build your career, what would your perspectives be of this? And do you have any recommendations or winning formulas that have worked for you?
I wish, Amelia, do you? But okay, I'll give you my experience. Is that I think for years I tried to get some kind of a balance, especially when I had kids. I think it's much easier when you don't have kids because you are more autonomous. You are more kind of the mistress of your own time. But over the years, I've accepted that I have to take a long view, and that everyday balance is kind of an ideal that's never going to be reached. So you can never say, I'm going to spend this many hours at work focusing on work and that many hours at home focusing on my children or on my family, or, you know, it just doesn't work like that. And I think that so now the way that media works, and with being able to work online and on the internet, it's a huge help because you can actually disperse your time. So you don't have to. It makes you physically much more able to move around. So, for example, this is kind of a bad example, but if one of my children had a gala, it's a bad example because they both hate swimming and they're very unlikely to be in a gala. But if they did have a gala, I could theoretically take 3 hours off work and go and watch them at the gala and monitor my email while I was there and just see if there was a huge crisis that I'd needed to respond to. It makes you much more flexible. So you are able to be more present in your kids' lives. But, okay, having said that, the conclusion that I've reached is that at some times in my life, I'm going to be much more involved in my career and less involved in my family life. And at other times, it's going to be the other way around. And I've kind of made peace with that. I think that my cycle works in a monthly rhythm because of being a monthly magazine primarily, although now that we've got the two magazines, we're kind of producing a magazine every 2 weeks. So I would say that 1 week is very hectic and it's very work-focused, and sometimes I work late, and the other week is much, much less work-focused, and then I'm much freer to spend more time with my kids and more time at home and much more flexible. And I think that as I've progressed as an employer or as a boss, I'm very keen on giving my employees flexi time. I'm very interested in allowing them to work from home, to come in at about 10:30 in the morning, not only because it alleviates kind of traffic situations, but because they can work from home. I think they're women. We need to be able to monitor our own time. We've got so much to do that it's much more, it's. I think women tend to work better if we feel that we are more in control of our time. I don't know what your experience is. Would you say the same thing?
Well, I would say that one of the biggest advantages has been from a technology point of view. The fact is that you can access things anytime, anywhere, and be responsive. And looking at, again, that dynamic of 24 hours in a day, but how they're carved up and making time work for you rather than you working for time.
Yes, that is such a challenge. And there, the one thing that I have done is that I am only kind of nominally on Facebook, because I think that is a massive sucker up of time. I used to absolutely adore Twitter, and I was kind of quite addicted to it. And so Twitter I also probably look at once a day. So I think I'm very strict with the amount of time I spend on social media, because I think that it can just suck up all your time.
Well, it goes continuously. I wouldn't even say it's 24/7. It's 60 seconds of every minute of every hour of every day. There is always something on the go.
Yeah, so, and it's often got the illusion of being, it seems important, but it's actually not important. And Nassim Taleb, I love him, the kind of behavioral economist who wrote The Black Swan. And he says, and I thought it was so interesting, he said something that he had taken, he doesn't watch the news anymore, and he said he was off all social media, even though he did actually say this on Twitter, so he's obviously on Twitter. But he said, because the news, if it's important enough, will find him. And I thought that was such a liberating attitude, actually, in a way, because I think you get so involved in the minutiae of what's happening, who says what, that actually you kind of lose yourself in it, and you don't have any time to think about life, to think about what's going on. to consider your own life and consider your community's life and your country's life, you don't have time to do that anymore. There's no time for consolidating your thoughts. And I think that that was the point that he was making, and I've tried to incorporate a bit of that into my life.
I did hear an expression pertaining to social media that it's like drinking water from a water hydrant because you just have this deluge that that confronts you.
That's such a good image, actually.
Today we're talking to Miss Susie Brockenshaw, who is the editor of Fair Lady and Lose It.
Hi, this is Lyra, South African Afro Soul singer and songwriter. You're listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, presented by Dr. Amalia Malka on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, a program that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, and democracy.
Today, we're talking to Miss Susie Brockenshaw, who is the editor of Fair Lady and Lose It magazines. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at Womanity Talk. In the previous segment, Susie shared some of the challenges confronting the magazine industry and looking at how one needs to work on retaining community, focusing specifically on developing niche content to involve those specific audiences, and looking at how one is able to monetize the industry so that it remains sustainable. Susie, from a practical perspective, one of the most common problems affecting women in corporate SA with regards to women's legal rights and legislation doesn't seem to be an issue that we don't have enough legislation. Legislation abounds, but rather in terms of how we assist women and how we educate citizens about issues like gender equality in the workplace and women's rights. Based on your experience, how do you think women can achieve progress regarding issues that affect them?
This is such an interesting question. You know, the more I work and the more I kind of, well, the older I get, basically, I think that there is enough legislation. There really is, but it's about actually making that legislation work. And I increasingly feel as though in women's magazines, particularly, we are preaching to the converted. We're talking to women about abuse. We're talking to women about how to stand up for their rights in the workplace. We are talking to women about how to get their husbands to pay maintenance, or their ex-husbands, or the fathers of their children to pay maintenance, that we're constantly talking to women. And increasingly, I feel that we're talking to the wrong audience. We need to be talking to men. And increasingly, I feel that it's not women who should be talking to men, it's men who should be talking to men. So that's where I see the huge gap, and that's where I think that that's the direction that I think we should be moving in. The thing that I don't like about that is that I feel quite powerless about that because I'm not a man. So I feel like I need to rally a team of men and send them out to talk to people.
So it's a case of almost being able to influence the advocates of gender equality and try to get more persuasion happening within the male environment so that then there's a ripple effect when they talk to their peers.
Yes, I really think that. I mean, I find it really interesting that so many of the men I hear interviewed, often really kind of very impressive men who are starting their own businesses, who have taken huge risks, are very entrepreneurial, and they're really great. And they often give credit to the single mothers who raised them.
And I think that's one of the dynamics in South Africa that we really have to focus on, that the reality is we have got a tremendous number of single mothers raising families.
But then we've also got a huge kind of incident of terrible treatment of women. We've got huge rape statistics. I can never marry those two things in my head. How does it work that those men really appreciate their mothers? They understand the sacrifices that their mothers made for them. They understand the strength of those women. And then I'm not saying that it's the same men, but still there's a pervasive culture of abuse of women.
And again, maybe that is looking at from absent fatherhood and the fact that that was done to them, that maybe that is the cycle that they are familiar with, and that's the way society has been rolling in their views.
Yeah, I absolutely do think that, and I don't know how to counteract that, because I think the thing about absent fathers is really massive, not only for the sons that they raise, but also for the daughters. So one of the things that I would say about many of the strong women that I've met in my life is that one of the formative things about them was that they had a very strong relationship with their father, who appreciated them, never made them feel less than, either in terms of their looks or their abilities, and who let them feel that the world was theirs, that they could be an agent in the world on their own terms.
Reflecting on that and the conversations that I have had with women, I think that really is one of the key elements that has come through with a lot of them, is having a robust family network, support structure, present parents, giving them encouragement and the confidence to realize that they can do anything, whatever they want, irrespective of their gender. There are no boundaries.
Yes, exactly. I've absolutely experienced that in my life, yeah.
Now, in your role as a woman editor, sometimes from an African perspective, because the reality is that we do have a lot of patriarchy that pervades, but we also have, combined with that, elements that are quite sensitive, whether that's culture, religion, and tradition. In your experience, do you think that women in managerial positions face different challenges to their male counterparts, and are they judged differently?
I think we are judged differently. I think that if you look at the response, I'm just thinking now because it was so much in the public eye, but to Advocate Thuli Madonsela, where so much was made of her physical appearance as a kind of a takedown of her, rather than saying, you know, that they disapproved with the way that she dealt with specific issues, that it became about their physical appearance. So I think that that does happen in South Africa, and I think that does speak to the patriarchal system here. I think it's very difficult for women in management positions that it becomes not an ad hominem debate when they're being criticized for something that they're saying, that it becomes personal very quickly for women in management as opposed to men in management. And I remember Matthew Pauser, and I wish I could remember the statistics exactly, but he mentioned how many people didn't think that women should occupy positions of power. And the statistic was incredibly high. Between 18 and 34-year-olds, I think, in South Africa, it was about 35%. But the shocking thing was that about 45% of those people who responded were women.
Wow, I haven't seen those stats. I would love to see them. I think that when you are presented with stats like that, which seem to go against the grain and looking at all of the advances that we've achieved on gender equality, that when you have got large volumes of women who are saying that women shouldn't be in power positions, that is indicative of culture, it's indicative of society, and it's also indicative of the fact that we don't have enough women in positions of power to show and prove their competence and worth.
Yes, I think that is true. Even though, theoretically, we've got more women in position of power in terms of our parliament and all of that than ever before, I think that often those women, they are not role models. They don't stand up and talk up enough. And I think that that has a profound effect on the women who are looking at them.
It's true. But one of the things that I found, and you're right, South Africa currently is ranked 8th in the world in terms of the Interparliamentary Union on Representation of Women. I think we've got between 41 and 42%.
Yeah.
But I think the more telling part is what happens from an economic perspective. And in the business world, globally, the stats are abysmal.
Yes.
I think it's ranging probably around 20% of women in managerial positions. Then there was a South African study on women CEOs on the JSE, and the last figures in 2012 showed that only 3.6% of South African JSE-listed companies' CEOs were women. So I think that you're right. People do need to stand up when you are in those positions, but I think that on the corporate side, which is probably where people are more exposed, that also needs to improve.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with you. And I'm not sure how to make that happen other than to continue being a cheerleader and saying it is possible, you must do it, negotiate your way ahead, because it's not about the women. It's not necessarily about talking to the women. I think that women in those positions feel that they can progress, that they can run the company. It's about the men seeing that they can do that.
Mm. I think that's a very good diagnosis. To move the dial forward, it can't just be one-sided from a woman's point of view and taking gender equality, but it has to also come from men towards other men.
Yeah, I think it's really critical.
We are coming into the last run of the show, and during the programs that I've hosted, a question that I ask all of my guests is about the factors that they feel have contributed towards their success. Some people speak about hard work, others talk about perseverance. What would you say have been some of the contributing factors that have driven your success?
You know, it's interesting, given what I said about the importance of fathers, my mother is also a very, very powerful person, but I think that right from the very beginning in my family, both of them, they made me feel as though anything was possible, as though I could do anything, could be anything. They challenged me. They made me think. When we were kids, it was very kind of uncommon for kids of about 6 or 7 or 8 to eat dinner with their parents. They always ate earlier, and then the parents would eat later. That kind of seemed to be the way that we were being brought up in KwaZulu-Natal. But my dad always insisted that we ate supper with them, but we had to have something to talk about. We couldn't just sit there and complain about the food or do whatever we were doing. We actually had to have something interesting to say about the day. And I think that that was a really formative thing. It made me look around and think about what I was going to talk about at dinner that night. They were very loving as well, so it wasn't a strict thing. It was just you had to be interesting. And so that was the first thing. The second thing, I think, was I went to a school, again, where that was reinforced, that you could do anything, that hard work could make you anything. You could be president, you could be whatever you wanted to be. So I never, ever felt that there were things that were not available to me. It just wasn't in the way that I thought. I remember the first time when I came across a man who treated me differently because I was a woman, or who ignored what I said because I was a woman. It was such a shock to me. I'm afraid to say I must already have left varsity or been at varsity, but I remember it being such a shock that somebody would treat me like that. And so then I think the second thing kicked in, and that was resilience. And I think resilience is a very underrated quality. You do get broken down, you do get bashed down, and it's naive to think that that isn't going to happen to you. It will happen to you, but the trick is, as many people have said, how fast you get up. And I do feel that that's a big part in my achievements, is that I get up very fast.
What I also picked up from what you've said has been, you almost had the socio-cultural component of nurturing and being fostered through from your parents for the support. But then you had the functional side of going out, doing hard work, and learning the skills of being resilient and bouncing up and responding and being able to use the strength and go through to the next leg.
Absolutely. But there is one other thing that I would like to say, and I think has probably changed over the years, because now I'm in my 50s, so the way I was raised is probably different to the way that women are being raised now. I certainly hope it is. But I do remember being taught that it was very vulgar to talk about money. And I remember the first two jobs that I got, and I think this is different for men. I don't think men were raised like this at all. But the first two jobs that I got, I actually accepted the job before I discussed the salary. And the reason that I bring this up is because a lot of women that I've spoken to said they did the same thing, that they just thought it was so embarrassing to talk about money or to ask for a raise or to say that they felt that they were worth more than that. And so they just never brought it up, and they carried on working and working for less money or for less money than they felt they deserved because they thought it was kind of unfeminine. I don't even want to use that word, to talk about money. And I think that that is absolutely critical, that we get that right with women, that we must talk about money. We must talk about what we're worth. We must discuss it before we take a job. It's crazy not to, and I really hope that it has changed in the intervening years. But that was definitely the one thing that I was really, really bad at.
I'm very glad that you raised that point, because it is so important to be autonomous, to be economically independent, and to reduce these wage parities that
Absolutely.
Still exist.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that happened was I was invited to join. When I first started working, I was invited to join a women's investment club, which I thought was absolutely hilarious because I had no idea how to invest money, first of all. And second of all, I was earning so little that I had no money to invest. But what it did do was we would meet once a month, and instead of a book club, we actually spoke about investments. We spoke about shares that we thought that we should be interested in or what was going on in the stock market. It was immensely empowering because it made me able to talk about money.
I think that's a wonderful initiative, and it would almost be great when we talk about looking at some of those business models that maybe that's a sideline that comes out of the publishing angle on looking up establishing niche societies.
Yeah, that's such a good idea, actually.
Lastly, can I please ask you, as we close out the show today, if you could share a few words of inspiration which you'd like to pass on to young women and girls in Africa that are listening to us?
Well, I think based on what we've already discussed, what I would really like to say is you, and at the risk of sounding like Freddie Mercury, you can be anything you want to be. You can. You can do it. You have to believe in yourself. You have to have the strength of your convictions. You have to be prepared to work extraordinarily hard. And you have to be prepared to negotiate your way forward and be aware of your own worth in order to do that from a place of authenticity. But you can do it. You will be knocked down, get up again, and carry on. Having said all of that, I would also add, be a good colleague, because I think that everybody wants their work life to be a stimulating and encouraging environment. And I think that part of that is being a good colleague, being collegial to the people that you work with, helping them out when they need help. It's not about scrabbling over them. It's about working with people, because then people will always want to work with you.
Thank you for sharing those pearls of wisdom, which are very, very practical.
Yes, very practical. Okay. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Amelia.
Likewise. And we wish you all the best with 2017 and the journey of both Fair Lady and Lose It.
Thank you. Thank you. And you too, all the best with 2017.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance. And we have been talking to Ms. Susie Brockenshaw, who is the editor of Fair Lady and Lose It.